Water quality has been an issue in Iowa for a long time.
Fish were already declining in quality by 1893. This is because there's so much soil moving in the rivers.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we continue our summer series, Ripple Effects, exploring Iowa's environmental challenges with an in-depth look at water quality. Water flows through our farm fields and feedlots, through our cities and towns, and Iowa's water quality affects every one of us. We'll track the evolution of water quality in the state, pinpoint some of the key sources for pollution, and talk about solutions. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. Today, we continue our summer talk show series, Ripple Effects, exploring Iowa's environmental challenges. Coming up today at noon on River to River, we'll talk about air quality. And this hour, the topic is water. The story of water quality in Iowa is a complicated one. We'll talk about sources of pollution, water quality monitoring, and the future. But first, Talk of Iowa producer Lindsay Moon is going to help us start at the very beginning.
In talking about what this show could be about, we decided we needed to define what a watershed is. I realized I couldn't, and I wasn't the only one. I asked a few other people what they thought.
It is the underground runoff from rivers as it runs through like the limestone. I think that's what it is.
It's the excess water that pools next to a larger body of water, I think.
I have no idea.
A watershed is basically a basin where water collects and concentrates.
The environment where the rain falls and the sort of water passes through the area into the sort of main waterways, rivers, lakes, so forth.
Well, not exactly, but we're getting closer. To help explain this concept, I met up with Greg Brennanman, an agricultural engineering specialist with Iowa State University Extension down by the Iowa River. He says this really isn't that complicated.
Really, anywhere where we live, the rainfall that falls is going to run off somewhere, and that's going to contribute to a stream or a river. And all the area that contributes water to that particular river or stream is the watershed that makes up that river or stream.
So really anywhere water runs?
Yeah.
See? Simple. There are several watersheds in Iowa. It works like this. Right now, I'm in Iowa City. I'm also in Johnson County, in Iowa, in the United States. Similarly, I'm in the Iowa River watershed, in the Lower Iowa watershed, in the Mississippi River watershed. These boundaries exist to help scientists identify pollutants and sources of pollution along our waterways. Smaller watersheds are always a part of bigger watersheds. It goes back to the same concept. All water flows. Brennanman says even though we don't always think about it, we all affect our water quality at all times. Think about it like a potluck.
We get together with some other friends in the fall and we have a chili supper, and we each bring a little bit of chili and dump it into a big pot. And so ultimately what we have is a mixture of what everybody has brought to it. And essentially that is also what we see here. It's a mixture of all of our land uses, all of the things that we do that end up contributing water.
So, the next time you flush the toilet or dump something down the drain, think about your watershed. What are you bringing to the potluck? In the Lower Iowa watershed, I'm Lindsay Moon, Iowa Public Radio News.
Now that we know what a watershed is and how we're all connected, let's talk about what's in our water in Iowa. With me now is Keith Schilling. He is a research scientist at the Iowa Geological Survey. Hello, Keith.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Now, concerns about water quality in Iowa are not new. So give us a little bit of the long-range picture. When did we first start seeing reports of bad water quality in Iowa?
Well, I think you'd be surprised as how old an issue this really is. That, you know, part of this question is always about where do you start, comparing what water quality today to what? Well, if we go back and compare it to prairie, we're a lot worse than we were, you know, 150, 200 years ago with native prairie. But really, the minute our early settlers turned over the sod, we started contributing to water quality impairments. By 1900 to 1920, that was probably as bad as Iowa water quality has ever been.
Really?
Yeah, because there was no wastewater treatment from cities. So cities were essentially discharging all their waste into streams. Or we channelized so many rivers around that time period. We also tile drained everything that we could. So all those factors were contributing to, you know, massive water quality impairment that we're still probably recovering from in a lot of cases.
So during that time period, what kind of records do we have about the water quality from then?
Not very many. Unfortunately, the data is really sparse, you know. So we can think there was a study that was done in 1905-06 that showed nitrate, you know, which is a concern of today, was really low. You know, it's like half a milligram per liter. And that increased over time to the 50s. It was 2 and 3. And then by the last couple of decades, average in these big rivers is probably 6 or 7. So we see that that's gotten a lot worse. But that doesn't really tell the whole story about water quality. That's just one pollutant. But we really have very little monitoring that extends back in time.
All right. So we know that during that time, of course, sewage was going straight into our streams, rivers, lakes, and clearly that's not something that we want. But we also did see a lot of topsoil washing away because it was a resource that we felt was going to be there forever, right?
Yeah. You know, it's funny. If you look at early air photos, the state has this amazing archive of air photos from the 1930s and 40s. If you look at the agricultural land from the air, there's no way to tell what the topography is. Everybody farmed at right angles, up and down hills. There wasn't a lick of conservation anywhere. In fact, that was probably the greatest period of sediment loss that we've ever seen, is when we were farming in that way. And it took a long time, several decades, for conservation to catch up.
Now, after the 1920s, we built wastewater treatment plants. We got the sewage out of the water, and we learned a little bit about what happens, of course, when you pollute your water, fish kills and all sorts of other things. And, of course, we know that we need clean drinking water. So the science has gotten better. We've learned a lot over time. How have things changed in our water quality over time once we did start monitoring?
You know, It's also one of those factors where, okay, now we're thinking about the last few decades. Well, our worst period for sediment loss was, we did a study where we looked in the Raccoon River and found out that the greatest period of sediment loss was in 1972-73. You know, Freedom to Farm Act occurred, fence row to fence row planting combined with the above average precip. That was the greatest single year or two of sediment loss the Raccoon River has ever seen. However, you know, that's one parameter. If you look at other things, we've relatively stabilized over the last couple of decades. That usually water quality, you know, there isn't a real common trajectory on if it's getting better or worse. It's just where, you know, some are slightly better, some are slightly worse. But overall, there's not much of a trend.
All right. So since when? Since the 1980s?
Yeah, I'd say through the mid-80s.
So let's try to put that
in mid-80s to present.
Okay, let's put that in perspective. So we have learned a lot. We know a lot more about water quality. The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is growing every year. I mean, we have a greater understanding of how we're all connected and what we put in our water, how it affects those downstream, and what the dead zone was the size of New Jersey last year. But we have stalled out since the 1980s.
Yeah, you know, what's happened is that our period of rapid land use change has slowed. We plant 70% of Iowa ground and row crop now. You know, whether it's 71%, you know, and 30 million acres in Iowa, you know, that's a lot of ground. Everybody's kind of figured out what their fertilizer applications are. We don't see a lot of variation in that in times. So there's just, and then we see on top of that, we see wide fluctuations in rainfall and climate. So on top of relatively stable conditions, we see very unstable climate in terms of droughts, floods, et cetera. And that is the main source of, you know, a good year versus a bad year. It's what's the climate doing?
We know that water quality is an issue in Iowa. Why do you think we have stalled out? Why aren't we making improvements?
You know, it's also a question of scale, because you see it with individual farmers. You see it in some watersheds. But the scale of the issue, I think, is the big challenge. You know, so you take a watershed like the Cedar River, that's 6,500 square miles. There are a lot of people, a lot of farmers in that watershed to make a difference. What sort of percentage do you need of all these people to show an effect? If you scale down and said, I have a 10-square-mile watershed, we can have an effect there. It's scaling up that's the problem.
All right. One really nasty pot of chili can, can make a really big difference, right?
Yeah, because we've seen it. I was involved in a long-term project at the Neil Smith National Wildlife Refuge in Jasper County. There was a case where the Fish and Wildlife Service came in, converted 25% of the watershed into row crop, or from row crop to prairie. We saw an improvement in 10 years. Nitrate concentrations went down, but that was 25% of a small watershed. You know, you're not going to get 25% land use conversion in the Cedar River to see the similar effect if it should scale the same.
Right. So if we take these small snapshots and monitor water quality around the state, could you look at water samples and be able to tell me what the land around there is used for?
You sure can for something like nitrate, because we did a study 10 years ago or so that looked at the relationship between row crop land use in a watershed and what the stream nitrate concentrations might be. And lo and behold, it was almost a linear straight line relationship, where if you take the amount of row crop in a watershed, say 70%, and multiply it by 0.1, it'd be 7. That's the mean annual nitrate concentration in the watershed. There's a very direct relationship for some things. Other things are not quite so easy. Nitrate is a type of pollutant that lends itself to something like this.
And a lot of us hear a lot about nitrates, but remind us, what problems do they cause in our water? Because they are very, very much present.
Yeah. Well, nitrogen and phosphorus are nutrients. Okay, so producers add those to their fields, encourage plant growth, crop development. Excess loss of those in the surface water is also a nutrient for aquatic plants. Okay, so they get in our streams, they cause algae blooms. That algae blooms eventually, like in the Gulf, they decay, decompose, and that decomposition reduces the dissolved oxygen in the water. So the plant nutrients are also stream nutrients. But that's just the nutrients. We also have issues of bacteria
and a lot of other things.
Yeah.
We're going to take a short break. We'll get back to talking about some of those other issues in a moment. And we're going to focus on first row crops and their effect on the waterways around them. We'll talk about animal confinements also, and we'll talk about your concerns as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we continue our talk show series, Ripple Effects, exploring Iowa's environmental challenges. And this hour, we're taking an in-depth look at water quality in Iowa. With me now is Keith Schilling. He is a research scientist at the Iowa Geological Survey. And joining the conversation is Jeff Van Steenberg. He is supervisor of the Mason City Environmental Services Field Office for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. Hello, Jeff.
Good morning.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Yeah, you're welcome.
And we've been talking about row crops and the kind of impact that kind of farming can have on waterways and the greater watersheds. And Dick Sloan is joining us now. Dick Sloan farms 720 acres outside of Brandon in eastern Iowa, and he is part of the performance-based watershed management project. He monitors the water quality on his own farm. Hello, Dick.
Good morning. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today. And you farm, as I mentioned, about 720 acres, two-thirds in corn, about a third in soybeans, about 20 acres of fall grain. So tell me when you first got involved in monitoring your water quality.
I was involved in a Lime Creek Watershed Project, which started up in 2006. The Northeast Iowa Watershed Extension Project's office contacted us as farmers in the watershed. Lime Creek is listed on the 2004 list, Iowa's 303D list of impaired water bodies. We had, at one time, I think we had 8 species of mussels living in Lime Creek, and then we dropped down to 0 at the monitoring point. Since then, we've found a different monitoring point that's farther away from the cedar that has 5 of those species. So it's not a total decline, but still it's an indicator that we had some water quality things that we wanted to address.
All right. So when they got in touch with you and started talking about Lime Creek and things that you could do to possibly make the water quality better in your area, what was your response?
Well, I was open to it. I'm interested in trying to farm with minimal damage to the environment. I don't think that economics overrules, you know, responsibilities to our natural environment. So
what do you do? How do you actively monitor your water?
Well, we work with Coe College down to Cedar Rapids and Dr. Marty St. Clair's office, and he's been monitoring Lime Creek at the outlet into the Cedar River, along with a lot of the other streams above Cedar Rapids. Cedar Rapids drinking water levels are safe. They draw from sand wells near the river. The river itself has reached above the safe drinking water standards, and so they're trying to head off possible costs down the road that could, you know, come along and trying to see what can be done to make the farming a less leaky system. So we expanded his monitoring farther up into Lime Creek and had this project where we looked at soil conditioning index, which is a indicator of organic matter being built in the soil. That's good because better organic matter will hold on to nutrients better. Then also phosphorus indexes to see if there was erosion problems and things. So we test for nitrate, nitrogen, dissolved reactive phosphorus, dissolved oxygen.
And were you able to pinpoint some problems on your farm?
Well, not specifically yet. What we did over the project, we felt like our stream over the period of years when our project was running strong through 2006 through 2010, we had good funding from the Water Resources Board down to Des Moines to run our project. We had pretty good reduction in nitrate compared to the other streams in the middle cedar, and so we felt like we were making some progress. And then since then, I think they've pretty much kind of been rolling along with the other streams in the area. We haven't really seen a lot of progress. So what we asked last summer was for a grant to install tile line monitoring stations, and so we're still in the process of working on those stations and getting them all involved, set up and stuff. But we've begun to get some information back.
Dick, how about the other farmers in your watershed? Have you found that your neighbors are also willing to participate in this?
Well, yeah. We've got 7 sites set up now, and we're going to have 10 so that we can try to compare our different farming systems and be able to see what changes would be most beneficial for our farms, rather than have something that, gee, we think we're doing the right thing. We'll maybe get more accurate information exactly to when we put nitrogen on and when do we see nitrogen in our tile lines and what types of rotations we use, whether or not we use cover crops, if we're using more aggressive tillage or like I'm participating in the NRCS Soil Conservation Stewardship Program, and they have a soil health initiative there that looks at keeping plants living on the ground year-round. In my case, that's cover crops and stuff.
Now, Dick, I have to ask you, because farmers are businessmen and women, and of course they need to make money. You are dependent on the money that you make from your farm for your future. You obviously care about the future of the land and water in Iowa, but Is this a financial liability for you? Do you feel like you're losing money, or do you feel like you're having to put in a lot more effort without any financial return?
So nitrogen costs about 55 cents an acre or a pound for nitrogen to be put on in my fields. So it's a fairly expensive input, and I want to make sure that I'm making best use of that. At the same time, for me to split apply my nitrogen, it costs me another $8 an acre to get over the ground. So that's pretty much equivalent to 14.5 pounds of nitrogen. Well, if I just decided, gee, I'm not going to be sure I can make that second trip or do something else, well, then, you know, maybe I'll just put on an extra 20 pounds of nitrogen. I think that's, if you looked at some of the surveys and stuff that they've done of farmers, that most farmers feel that that's appropriate to put on that extra, that safety factor, so that if you do get excessive rains, that you'll still not hurt your yield. But then that's a cost to our environment.
Right.
I don't know how to solve that problem.
Well, Dick, a lot of people don't know how to solve that problem. You're not alone. Dick, thank you so much for talking with us today. Dick Sloan farms 720 acres outside of Brandon in eastern Iowa. He's part of the Performance-Based Watershed Management Project. And Jeff Van Steenberg is here, supervisor of the Mason City Environmental Services Field Office for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. And Jeff, listening to Dick talking about all the work that he's done to try to monitor the water quality around his area, the extra effort he's willing to put into making the environment safer and healthier in his area. Can you give us some insight on the kind of oversight that we have in Iowa as far as monitoring water quality? How close an eye does the DNR keep on this?
Well, the state law has water quality standards. They're in the Iowa Administrative Code, in the Code Rules, Chapter 61. So, and those are looked at on a periodic basis to make sure that they're up to date, to make sure that that there's good science behind them. So we do have that framework. And as far as the monitoring, there is statewide monitoring. I know, well, years ago, back when I worked for the State Hygienic Laboratory at Iowa City, we ran routine monitoring sites throughout the state, collected water. So there is that data being collected and being stored and analyzed by people like Keith and that. So we have an idea what's going on. As far as day-to-day type things, the state of Iowa has primacy for the wastewater treatment program and for the NPDES program, which stands for National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. And that permitting system addresses point sources. What Dick was talking about had more to do with the non-point source.
Right, and define this for us, for people who aren't familiar with the terms. Point source is?
Yeah, point source, I guess the easiest way to describe it is it's the end of the pipe. It's when you can go down to your municipal wastewater treatment plant, there's a pipe after all the treatment and the effluent is discharged at that point, or an industry, that type of thing. Non-point source is... again, as Dick described, you know, the water falls on the land. It makes its way to first to small waterways, either over the surface or through tile lines, and then eventually it goes to bigger streams until it reaches the river. So,
and it's very hard to know if there's pollution involved in that. It's very hard to know where it's coming from.
Exactly. You know, there's been studies done. I know on the Clear Lake Lake Improvement Project, they even found that there was a certain amount of nutrient, even in the rainfall, as it's coming down. They detected phosphorus in some of the rainfall, and there's other things. So, you know, it comes from diverse sources. There's what we do to the land. There's also things coming from urban areas. You know, water runs off the streets and picks up pollutants. And so, non-point source really is a big thing. You know, trying to get you wrap your arms around it can be a real challenge.
All right. And Keith, from your perspective, do we have a good handle on our water quality in Iowa? I know that there have been volunteer programs to monitor water quality around the state on some of our smaller streams and waterways. Do we know what's going on?
Well, we know at a certain size. I keep coming back to the scale issue, but our water monitoring program that Jeff was talking about is geared at larger watersheds, so from 300, 500, 800, 1,000 square miles. And we know something about the water quality discharging from those, but we sample, say, 60 to 80 of these sites every month. So we got monthly samples at a lot of spots. Monthly samples will tell you one thing. It won't tell you anything about what happens during an event, because that could occur any time in the month. So we don't have really this temporal resolution in that. And we don't have the scale. So what Dick was talking about in Lime Creek is a much smaller scale. That's a project kind of level monitoring, you know, to see what goes on when one producer does one thing. That's a different kind of monitoring than statewide monitoring, which is trying to cover, you know, 80% of Iowa with 60 stations.
Right. We have a lot of people who want to get involved in this conversation. We're talking about water quality this hour on Talk of Iowa with Keith Schilling, research scientist at the Iowa Geological Survey, and Jeff Van Steenberg from the Department of Natural Resources. You can join the conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jacob is on the line in Rock Island. Hi, Jacob.
Hi.
Hi. What would you like to talk about?
Well, as I was saying earlier, I'm working with Augustana College in Rock Island, and we've been doing a project with the watershed, well, all summer. And I was, as it was mentioned earlier in the show, the levels that we've gotten have been also everywhere. They're like for example, the ammonia levels have been so high at some places where they've been not detectable by the meter because they've been so high. And within the same watershed itself, we measure three sites per every watershed, the ravine, the confluence, and the headwater. And within each watershed, there the nitrate levels and the phosphorus levels and the ammonia levels have been different at the different sites, some of them to great levels, like great extents. So it's been the levels have all been crazy, and it's been very different all over the place.
Now, of course, it's been a year of flooding. Is that one of the theories about what's going on with all of these crazy levels, Jacob?
Yeah, there's actually several projects going on right now within the overall project, and that's been looked at also, but some of them, one of the projects has to do with, like, the landslides and what's going into the water as it floods and it rains, and, like, fecal coliform and sediment layers. So there's a lot of different projects that are going into this watershed project that we're doing. But overall, the results have been pretty interesting.
All right. Jacob, thank you so much for sharing that information with us. And Keith, could you respond to that? I mean, like I mentioned, this is a year of flooding, which I suppose really throws some factors out of whack. What can we learn from that?
Well, you know, if you think about, there's two things you can look at for water quality. One is the concentration in the stream. So it's milligrams per liter. The other is the load, which is the concentration times the discharge. So that's the total mass of a pollutant going downstream. So what Jake was talking about was a concentration issue where they're going to a certain spot, measuring that value, and it can be high or low. Doesn't tell you anything necessarily unless he's measuring discharge about the mass going downstream. It tells you something different. I'm a little bit curious about the high levels of ammonia. That's not something we typically see from a non-point source issue. By the time we get into non-point source at bigger rivers, all that ammonia has been oxidized to nitrate by that time. So ammonia is usually a kind of a warning sign for a point source impact or some other way to get ammonia into that waterway.
All right. And Jeff, maybe you could respond too. If we see a hot spot like that, if monitoring shows something up, what can you do? How do you respond?
Well, we're very concerned about ammonia because especially aquatic organisms are quite sensitive to ammonia, and so that's one of the parameters that's monitored at most point source discharge permits. And so I guess if if people are seeing high levels of ammonia, that's something that the DNR field office in that area might want to hear about, and it's something they can check into and are able to follow up on. Like Keith said, what we do is start to look for a source, you know, whether that be, maybe a wastewater treatment plant that is having some kind of an issue where it's not being able to reduce the ammonia, or it could be from livestock production, or even we've had some significant problems from spills, fertilizer spills. There's some historic ones that really stand out in my mind anyway, where high ammonia was a problem. So that is definitely something that the department would be interested in and could look at.
All right, and when you find a source, we have a break coming up here in just a second. So in 30 seconds, can you tell me what happens next if you find the source of this pollution?
Well, depending on what that source is, if we have, we'll say, a responsible party or an entity or of some kind, we try to work with them to, first of all, get it stopped. That's the number one thing. We want to protect water quality. And then from that point on, we continue to provide compliance assistance and technical assistance to see if, okay, now that we've got it, the immediate problem stopped, let's see what we can do over the long term to help to make sure that this doesn't happen again.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about water quality on Talk of Iowa today as we continue our summer series on the environment. With me, Jeff Van Steenberg. He's supervisor of the Mason City Environmental Services Field Office for the Iowa DNR. And Keith Schilling, research scientist at the Iowa Geological Survey. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're continuing our environmental series on Talk of Iowa with an in-depth look at water quality in the state. Keith Schilling is here with me. He's a research scientist at the Iowa Geological Survey. Jeff Van Steenberg is supervisor of the Mason City Environmental Services Field Office for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We've been talking a lot about nutrients in our water and some of the places that those are coming from, some of the problems they can cause, and we'll talk more about that. We also want to talk about another source for pollution in the state of Iowa. Feedlots, whether they're small or large, can be a significant source of pollution in our waterways. Rita Dvorak lives outside of Riceville, Iowa. She lives next to a cattle feedlot. She's also a member of Iowa Citizens for Community Improvement. Hello, Rita.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
And I know that you live on a small acreage. So you're living on about 17 acres. You have some sheep on your land. You also have a pond that you've put into your property, right?
Correct, yes.
So you also live next door to a feedlot. What kind of operation do you live next door to?
Well, that particular lot probably has about 600 feedlot cattle, as well as a cow-calf operation, and that sits on about 20 acres.
All right.
And that's one of multiple sites that the owner-operator manages.
All right, but we're not talking about some of the very largest kinds of feedlot operations.
Correct.
In the state. What kinds of problems have you experienced?
Well, our latest situation was, you know, in the spring of 2013, you know, there was a lot of manure runoff that came directly into our property, into the pond, just really a lot along the fence line. So we reported it to the DNR and been working with them concerning that issue.
All right, so you had runoff coming directly from the feedlot into your pond. We actually have a picture of that polluted pond up on our website as well.
Right, actually, that's one of the small ones. That the larger pond that we had the issue with that was in the back of the property, that the one that I sent was a picture one of just a very small pond that was made, you know, as a watering for the sheep. But okay, we have multiple problems on the property, as well as a ravine that's got a lot of runoff that's sitting in it still.
All right, and what have you had to do to try to reclaim your waterways?
Well, we are in a holding pattern. You know, we were working with the DNR, and we know that it's not going to do us any good to clean this up until the situation is resolved. The DNR is, you know, working on a plan fix that problem. We had a similar problem in 2009, and we had gone ahead at that time and when it was a dry year, you know, pumped the pond, cleaned it out, because, you know, we thought that the DNR was monitoring, you know, the situation, but, you know, we've learned a lot since then.
All right, so you actually spent around $15,000 that year to clean out the pond.
Right.
And then this spring, with a whole lot of water everywhere in the state of Iowa, there was also a significant problem on that property. Describe what you saw this year.
Well, as I said, the project was in process. There was a berm put in late in the fall. You know, it was built with frozen ground, so it really wasn't that, you know, durable. So in April, May, that berm was breached, and there was a very large amount of runoff that went directly into the river.
Okay. And into the Wapsipinicon River? Or the
Correct.
Okay. Well, Rita, thank you so much for sharing your story with us today.
Well, I do want to, there is a couple of things I did want to say, if that's all right.
Very
okay.
quickly.
Okay. Well, as I said, you know, one of the things that, you know, we are in a holding pattern for is the solution I am not happy with. This is a settling basin, so I do not expect that the solution is going to be a good outcome for us.
All right, Rita, thanks a lot for your call.
Yes.
And, of course, I understand that we can't comment specifically on this case. But Keith, can I turn to you? And we've talked a lot about nutrients in the water. How significant is this kind of pollution that Rita was describing in the state of Iowa?
Well, we actually did cover this a little bit because what Jeff mentioned too is high sources of ammonia. That's often associated with manure runoff. So we do get high nitrogen in terms of ammonia, high phosphorus levels, and of course, a lot of bacteria. So it's not water you want to come in contact with. It's not water at all that you can do much anything with except, you know, move it on and get it off your property. And hopefully, you know, Mother Nature will take course
right.
later on. But
And Jeff, again, I know you can't comment particularly on this case, but when there are repeated problems from a feedlot in Iowa, where there are repeated fish kills and manure spills and pollution incidents, what can the DNR really do?
Well, we've got, first of all, we have to operate within the what's described in the Iowa Administrative Code as far as the rules. You know, the ones that govern feedlots, a lot of those rules they pertain to the size of the feedlot. There's very small operations probably have the simplest set of rules, and then there's what we refer to as medium-sized animal feeding operations, and it cranks up a little more. And then when you get over, for example, 1,000 animal units, that's when you see the highest level of regulation. So, you know, first of all, we have to determine where that feedlot is. Secondly, we work with the owners. You know, we have thousands and thousands of contacts with the regulated public every year, and probably less than 2% of those result in legal action. And I know a lot of times that's what people want right away. They want somebody fined, you know. And that's certainly available to us, and we can do that, and we will do that. But I think one of the things we always try to do first is, like I discussed before, is to go in and do compliance assistance, to do technical assistance, try to get people on the right track. And for the most part, Iowans are very willing to do that. We've seen operations spend not just thousands but tens of thousands of dollars to correct the issues and to take action. Now, if we do have a small number of producers or facilities that don't want to make those improvements, that don't feel that that's something they want to do, we can go the route. Probably our first option is we can issue what we call an administrative order, or we try to negotiate administrative consent order. And that usually spells out in a legal document what needs to be done, and most times there's a penalty attached to that.
Okay, so a fine. Talked about rural land use on this program a week ago and learned that there's never been a concentrated animal feeding operation or, I believe, even a feedlot in Iowa that was shut down by the Department of Natural Resources.
No, we really don't have the power to do that.
Okay.
You know, we can.
So you can levy a fine, but it can't go much farther than that. And I
we can refer to the Attorney General's office. If
All right.
You know, we can take things up there, and Dave Sheridan is the head of the Agriculture and Natural Resource section, and he can handle things civilly. And we have even had animal feeding operations where we've had criminal charges, and that's a whole different section of the AG's office.
Okay.
But yeah, there are extremes that we can go to.
All right, Danielle is on the line in Woodward. Hello, Danielle.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I think the system is flawed at the legislative and administrative level. We do not have on the ground what will protect our groundwater and our surface water. Case in point, there's a new CAFO going in north of Woodward. It's just under the trigger level of 2,500 hogs. It's being built from a family corporation in Perry. Here's what's at risk. It's going to be situated at a high point on this watershed, and I'm talking the Des Moines River watershed. Manure will be land applied right across from the Boy Scout Camp Matigua. This water will flow into the Des Moines River. Water runs downhill. Your setup of explaining watersheds was absolutely brilliant. There are three high-quality streams, Bear Creek, Eversole Creek, and Catton Branch. All of those streams will be affected. They will flow right into the Des Moines River. I've monitored water and macroinvertebrates on two of those three creeks. That polluted water, first of all, Madrid will get it, then the city of Ankeny with their new filtration plant just south of the Sailorville Dam will get it, and then the Des Moines Water Works will get it.
Okay, so you're concerned that there's not enough oversight or regulation?
Absolutely not. These people who build these just under the limit hog lots can put them anywhere they want. I criticized the director of the DNR last week at an EPC meeting. I said, how could you
Danielle,
do
we're
this?
We're going to run out of time. So
okay.
Thank you so much. I believe you've made your point, and I'm sure that's something that you hear from a lot of people, Jeff.
Yeah, there is. And, you know, even the smallest operation still, there is rules and laws that that govern them. You know, all animal waste from a confinement feeding operation, a small one, must be land applied in a manner that won't cause surface or groundwater pollution. And it is used as a fertilizer. So that's something that, you know, if we receive a complaint on a small operation, that's going to be one of the first things we're going to look at is how is that waste being used? Is it being properly applied? Is there a cropping system involved that's going to use those nutrients? So, and we understand those concerns, and there's a lot of concerns not only from an environmental standpoint but from a social standpoint, and that's really where some of these get, is that they get out beyond just the science, and that makes it even more of a challenge, I guess, for everybody to deal with.
And there has been a lot of controversy recently over a proposed rule change from the Environmental Protection Agency, which now regulates water quality in waterways that are, quote, big enough to float a boat on, and now smaller streams, intermittent waterways, would come under the purview of the EPA as well. From your perspective, Keith, how does that change things in Iowa? Or would that? It has not gone into effect yet.
Yeah. Well, in terms of water quality, we can monitor those smaller systems, but again, there's a lot of small systems out there. So I think it's not going to be a huge deal for water quality unless people monitor and see impairments, and then all of a sudden it triggers rules and actions associated with that. So the thing about water quality, it's all in. You know, you could see it perhaps, but it's usually about measuring and getting real data to say that you have an impact. So all these small systems will have to be monitored if they want to be shown to have an impact.
Do we have a network that can do that?
Not currently. We do have the Volunteer Monitoring Network, which is great for the community involvement, and there's some good kind of basic information. It's not enough to be used for any sort of legal case or anything like that. But what it can do is be a tip-off that something's there that we need to get some scientific monitoring data to support.
Another controversial subject recently has been nitrates in the water, particularly in the Des Moines area in Iowa, very high nitrates in the Raccoon and Des Moines rivers. And so for cities, the water treatment plants have to remove those nitrates before they can, of course, distribute the water to the people who are going to drink it. And there are municipalities that put those nitrates back into the rivers because it's difficult to know what to do with them. What is your reaction to that problem? I know that there are a lot of water treatment plants who are frustrated with that problem.
Yeah, that's a tricky one, you know, and I don't know the legal framework behind any of that, that issue. But it intuitively, you'd wish that if it was taken out, it wouldn't be put back in because eventually the water's running downstream to the next city that might want to use that water. And if they have a nitrate impairment, they'll have to take the same nitrate out. So intuitively, it doesn't really make much sense.
All right. So at the beginning of the hour, you described to me how we kind of have stalled out since the 1980s as far as improving water quality in the state of Iowa. And we've talked about some of the sources for problems in the state. We also know that we know a lot more now than we did in the 1980s. So, Keith, what are our biggest problems, our biggest challenges to water quality in this state right now?
Well, I think in terms of it depends on the pollutant. Okay, so we've made huge strides in reducing sediment loss in Iowa. So we can count sediment loss or sediment in our streams as an improvement. We have seen changes, positive changes.
And there continues to be work on that as well.
Yep. The nitrogen and the nitrate, that's pretty much flatline. We did a study where we looked at all the monitoring sites in Iowa, the raw concentration data. 80% of them haven't shown a change since we started monitoring in 1998. So there isn't much change that we're seeing in nitrate, and the few that did show a change showed a positive, slightly positive increase.
So more.
More. Phosphorus, on the other hand, we're in the process of completing a study that way, and we've actually, it's really preliminary, but it seems to be showing a very, you know, 2 or 3% decrease. Not very much, but maybe it's on the positive side of things. So it's just really, it's really variable.
So we listened to Dick talk about the work that he's been doing on his farm, and he's really trying to make a difference. How many guys like Dick is it going to take to really make a difference with the nitrate levels in the state of Iowa that are heading into the Mississippi River?
Yeah, it's going to take a lot of people doing the thing that Dick's is doing to result in any sort of improvement. We have this nutrient reduction strategy that lays out a lot of practices, some more effective than others, but at least a whole host of practices that can be implemented. The key is that we have to get a lot of people to do it. It's just not one person who's probably already inclined to do something, somebody like Dick. It's everybody, even the people that are not so inclined to make a change. So we need the numbers of participants to increase.
Now, a lot of people consider this to be a problem that's at a crisis level. However, most of us don't see it on a day-to-day basis. What do you think it's going to take to get people to say, okay, I need to change my behavior? It's important to me.
You know, I think public opinion is one thing, and I think that has been shifting a little bit. I think that, interestingly, in the 1890s, people were saying the cities are the problem. Well, now the cities have done their work, you know, with the wastewater treatment plants. Perhaps it's time for the rural community to step up.
Keith, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Keith Schilling is a research scientist at the Iowa Geological Survey. Jeff, thank you so much.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you.
Jeff Van Steenberg is supervisor of the Mason City Environmental Services Field Office for the Iowa Department of Natural Resources. We continue our series, Ripple Effects, at noon today on River to River with an in-depth look at air quality. Talk of Iowa is produced by Lindsay Moon, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Claire Roth. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. I'm Charity Nebbe. This is Talk of Iowa.